The fire in the East Library had burned low by the time anyone thought to tend it. That was how it always was at Ashford Park. Rooms maintained to the precise standard of a house that was lived in, but never quite to the warmth of a house that was loved. The servants moved through the corridors with practiced efficiency. The silver was polished, the floors swept, the fires laid. But there was a quality to the silence that went beyond mere quiet. It was the silence of a house holding its breath, waiting for something it had stopped expecting. The Duke of Ashford had refused 3 consecutive seasons of introductions. The first year, society had attributed it to grief. His father had died 18 months prior, and mourning had its own calendar. The second year, they had called it eccentricity, which was a word the aristocracy reserved for behavior they could not control, but dared not condemn. By the third year, they had simply stopped sending invitations he would not answer, and the whispers had settled into something permanent, that Lord Edmund Ashford, 8th Duke of Ashford, had decided that the world beyond his estate was not worth the trouble of engaging. He had not corrected them. He was in the West Study when his housekeeper, Mrs. Holt, knocked twice in the particular rhythm that meant something required his attention that he would not enjoy. He did not look up from the correspondence on his desk. "Whatever it is," he said, "manage it. I'm afraid this one requires you, Your Grace." Mrs. Holt had served the Ashford household for 22 years. She had outlasted 3 dukes and 1 catastrophic kitchen fire, and she possessed the particular courage of someone who understood that the worst had already happened. "Your mother has sent a companion." The pen stilled. "I beg your pardon." "A Miss Cecily Vane, Your Grace, daughter of the late Reverend Vane of Derbyshire. Your mother writes that she is to serve as companion and to assist with the cataloguing of the library, which..." Mrs. Holt paused, with the diplomacy of long practice. "Has, as you know, been in some disorder since Mr. Pemberton retired." Edmund set down the pen. The cataloguing of the East Library had been in disorder for 14 months, because he had dismissed the previous librarian for rearranging the atlases by continent, rather than date of acquisition, and had not replaced him, because replacing him would have required interviewing candidates, which would have required conversation. "Send her back," he said. "Your mother anticipated that response, Your Grace." Holt produced a letter from her apron pocket with the air of a woman who had prepared for battle. "She asks me to remind you that Miss Vane has already traveled 4 hours by postchaise, and that turning her away would be both ungentlemanly and the sort of thing that would require your mother to visit in person to discuss." The silence that followed was of a different quality than the house's usual silence. It was the silence of a man calculating the lesser of 2 considerable inconveniences. "Where is she now?" "I've put her in the East Library, Your Grace. She asked if she might look at the collection while she waited, and I didn't see the harm." Edmund looked at the window, where the October light was already failing. He looked at his correspondence. He looked at the cold grate across the room, which someone had forgotten to tend. "Fine," he said. "She may stay the week. If she reorganizes anything without my approval, she goes back immediately." Mrs. Holt's expression did not change, but something around her eyes suggested she considered this a victory. "Very good, Your Grace." She was already gone when he thought to add that he had no intention of speaking to the woman. He found her 40 minutes later. He had not intended to go to the East Library. He had intended to take his usual evening walk through the portrait gallery, where the faces of his ancestors maintained the kind of silence he preferred, absolute, permanent, and incapable of requiring anything of him. But the route from the west study to the gallery passed the east library's open door, and the door was open, which was unusual, because he kept it closed, and the light inside was warm, which was unusual because he had told Mrs. Holt to keep fires in that room to a minimum, and there was a sound coming from within that he could not immediately identify. He stopped in the doorway. Miss Cecily Vane was sitting cross-legged on the floor in front of the Atlas cabinet. She had not heard him. She was entirely absorbed in what she was doing, which was, he looked again to confirm, mending a torn page. She had produced from somewhere a small kit of conservation materials, a strip of Japanese tissue paper, a pot of paste, a fine brush, no wider than a finger. The atlas in her lap was open to a spread of the Mediterranean, and the tear ran diagonally across the Adriatic Sea, a ragged wound someone had inflicted on the map at some point in the last century. She was repairing it with the focused, unhurried attention of someone who had done this before and understood that the work could not be rushed. Edmund stood in the doorway for longer than was necessary. She was not what he had expected. He wasn't certain what he had expected. Something more deliberate. Something that announced itself. She was perhaps 23, with dark hair that had escaped its pins during the journey and had not been fully recaptured, and she wore a traveling dress of dark green wool that had seen better seasons but was meticulously maintained. She was not beautiful in the way that the women his mother had previously attempted to introduce to him were beautiful. That studied, presented quality, like paintings hung at the correct angle. She was something else, absorbed, present, entirely unconcerned with being observed. He watched the brush move across the tissue paper. Precise, careful, he said without intending to. That atlas is 300 years old. She did not startle, which surprised him. She looked up with the unhurried calm of someone who had simply been waiting for the conversation to begin. I know, she said. That's why I'm mending it rather than leaving it to deteriorate further. She looked at him with the direct, assessing gaze of someone who had learned to form opinions quickly and trusted them. You must be the Duke. I am. I expected you to be taller, she said, and returned her attention to the Adriatic. Edmund Ashford had not been spoken to in that manner since he was 12 years old. He was not certain what to do with it. He stood in the doorway for another moment, and then, because the alternative was retreating, which felt unacceptable, he crossed the threshold and came to stand a few feet from where she sat. Where did you learn conservation, Ilivaitiaoan? He asked. My father's parish had a medieval manuscript collection. Damp climate, very little budget. I learned out of necessity. The brush moved again, feather light. Your atlas cabinet has been improperly sealed. The humidity has gotten to at least 4 of the volumes. I noticed when I was looking at the spines. I am aware. Are you? She glanced up briefly. Then I wonder why nothing has been done about it. It was not impertinence exactly. It was something more disarming than impertinence. It was the tone of someone who asked questions because they genuinely wanted to understand and had not yet learned to soften the directness of that wanting. Edmund found himself without an answer that he was willing to give, which was an unfamiliar position. The previous librarian, he said, was dismissed. And not replaced. No. For 14 months, according to Mrs. Holt, she set the brush down and examined the repair with critical attention. These atlases are remarkable. The Ortelius is in extraordinary condition for its age. The Bleu is less fortunate. She looked up at him again, and there was something in her expression that he couldn't categorize. Not challenge, not warmth, exactly, but something that sat between the two. I can repair the bleu if you'll allow it. The tissue work is straightforward, but the binding will need attention. Edmund looked at the atlas in her lap. The repair on the Adriatic was already nearly invisible. You may stay the week, he said. It was what he had told Mrs. Holt. It sounded different said aloud, in this room, to this woman sitting cross-legged on his floor, with paste on her fingers. That's very gracious, she said, in a tone that suggested she had not yet decided whether it was. He left before she could say anything else. He told himself, walking back through the portrait gallery, that it was simply a matter of the library requiring attention. The atlases were valuable. The humidity damage was a practical problem. The woman his mother had sent happened to have a useful skill. None of this was remarkable. None of this required further consideration. He was back in the East Library before breakfast the following morning. He told himself it was to check on the Ortelius. She was already there. She had arrived before the fires were properly lit, and had apparently solved this problem by pulling a chair close to the grate and working by the light of a branch of candles she had repositioned from the writing desk. She was cataloging, moving through the shelves with a small notebook, recording titles and conditions in a handwriting he could see from the doorway. Was very small and very neat. She heard him this time. She looked up, and something crossed her face. Not quite a smile, but the precursor to one, the shape a face makes before it decides. The bleu binding is worse than I thought, she said. The spine is separating. I'll need linen thread and a bone folder. I don't suppose your supply room. Mrs. Holt will have whatever you need. I'll ask her. She made a note. The Ortelius is fine. You were right to be concerned about the humidity, but it hasn't reached the interior pages yet. If you seal the cabinet properly, it should hold. He crossed to the shelves and stood beside her, looking at the collection. He had grown up with these books. He had spent the years of his father's long, cold decline in this room, reading. Because the rest of the house had not been safe for quiet. He knew the atlases the way one knows the furniture of childhood, not with the attention of appreciation, but with the unthinking familiarity of presence. He had not looked at them in 3 years. The Mercator, he said, almost without meaning to. The binding on the Mercator is original. She turned to look at him. Show me. He reached past her and drew the volume from the shelf. He was aware, with a precision that surprised him, of how close she was standing, close enough that he could have rested his chin on her head, if he had been the sort of man who did things like that, which he was not. He opened the Mercator to the title page and held it out. She took it with both hands carefully, the way one receives something that has been trusted. She looked at the binding, ran her thumb along the spine with a feather-light pressure, and made a small sound of genuine appreciation that was not performed for his benefit. Remarkable, she said quietly. It was not a word she threw at things. It meant something when she used it. They stood together looking at the Mercator for a moment that lasted slightly longer than practicality required. Miss Vane, he said. He, your grace. Why did you agree to come? She was quiet for a beat, turning the question over with the same careful attention she gave the atlases. Your mother wrote that the collection was in difficulty, she said. And I. She paused. Something shifted in her expression briefly before she settled it back into composure. I needed somewhere to be useful. That is an honest answer. He looked at her. What happened to the previous position? The family I was with returned to the country and had no further use for a companion. She said it evenly, without inflection, which was its own kind of answer. These things happen. He knew without asking that it had not been so simple. He recognized the particular quality of composure that was built over something that had hurt. He had been constructing his own version of it for 3 years. He said nothing. He returned the Mercator to the shelf. "I'll have Mrs. Holt bring the supply list to you," he said. "Thank you." He left. He did not tell himself, this time, that it was about the atlases. The week passed. He extended it without announcement. Simply did not tell Mrs. Holt that Miss Vane should be sent back, and Mrs. Holt did not ask. Another week followed. The East Library began, by degrees, to transform. The Atlas cabinet was properly sealed. The Bleu binding was repaired with a neatness that he examined when she was not present, running his finger along the spine, finding nothing but smoothness. She had developed a cataloging system that organized the collection by both acquisition date and geographic subject. With cross-references, she noted in the margins of the inventory in her small, precise hand. He found reasons to be in the library. They talked about the atlases, and then about cartography, and then about the history of exploration, and then about other things. The parish library she had grown up in, the particular quality of light in Derbyshire in autumn, the question of whether maps were more honest than written histories, because they could only represent what was physically present. She had opinions. She delivered them without apology and without aggression, the way someone speaks when they have spent a long time being listened to by no one and have consequently stopped editing themselves for an audience. He found this remarkable. He found her remarkable. He did not say so. The late-night conversations began by accident. He had developed the habit of working in the West study until midnight, and she had apparently developed the habit of returning to the library after dinner to work by lamplight, and one evening he passed the open door and saw the lamp burning and went in to tell her she ought to rest, and instead sat down in the chair across from hers and stayed until 2 a.m. They talked about his father that night. He had not talked about his father to anyone. "He was not a warm man," Edmund said. The fire had burned to embers. The library felt smaller in the dark, closer, the shelves pressing in with their accumulated weight of paper and knowledge. "He was not cruel. He had a way of making his disappointment felt without ever expressing it directly. I spent most of my childhood trying to anticipate what he wanted and being wrong." Cecily was quiet for a moment. "My father was the opposite," she said. "He was warm in the way that good fires are warm. Genuinely, without calculation. He didn't live very long. I've spent a great deal of time since wondering if that's why I find it difficult to trust warmth when I encounter it. Because it always seems like something that will run out." He looked at her across the low fire. She was looking at her hands, turned palm up in her lap as if she was reading something in them. "Miss Vane," he said. She looked up. "I think," he said carefully, "that you have been in rooms where the warmth was not genuine for long enough that you have forgotten what genuine feels like." She held his gaze for a moment. Something moved through her expression, something unguarded briefly before she recovered herself. "Perhaps," she said. "And you?" He considered the question honestly. "I think I removed myself from all rooms," Dane said, "to avoid the problem entirely." She looked at him with those direct, assessing eyes. "That does seem like a solution," she said, "in the way that removing the windows to prevent drafts is a solution." He felt something he had not felt in 3 years. It arrived without warning, and it was some time before he recognized it as the desire to laugh. He didn't, but it was close. He reached out across the arm of the chair, and she looked down at his hand, and then she placed her own hand in it, not dramatically, not with ceremony, just the simple settling of one palm into another, the way one puts a book back on the shelf where it belongs, They sat like that until the fire went out. The invitation arrived from Lady Pemberton on a Thursday. Edmund looked at it for a long time. He had not attended a social event in 3 years. He had not attended one with any genuine intention in considerably longer. Lady Pemberton's autumn gathering was not a ball, technically. She called it an assembly, which was a distinction without a meaningful difference. But it was the kind of event where the county gathered and assessed one another and made decisions about who was rising and who was falling in the unspoken mathematics of social standing. He thought about Cecily, about the way she had told him, without quite saying it, that she had been somewhere that had not valued her, about the composure she wore over something that had hurt. He went to the library. She was at the Atlas cabinet, making a final note in the inventory. She heard him come in and looked up with that almost smile. "The cataloging is nearly complete," she said. "I thought I might start on the general collection next if you..." She stopped. Something in his expression had registered. "What is it?" He held out the invitation. She took it. She read it. She looked up at him with an expression that was carefully neutral. "You don't attend these things," she said. "No." "Then why?" "Because I would like to attend this one." He held her gaze. "With you." The silence was very complete. "Your grace," she said, with the deliberate precision of someone choosing words with great care. "I am your mother's companion. I catalog your atlases." "I am not." "You are," he said. "The most interesting person I have encountered in 3 years of determined solitude, and I find that I would like to introduce you to the county. And I recognize that this is not a small thing to ask." She looked at him for a long moment. "It is not a small thing," she agreed. "No." Another silence. Then she looked down at the invitation in her hands and said very quietly, "I don't have anything suitable to wear to an assembly." "Mrs. Holt," he said, "will know what to do." Mrs. Holt did, in fact, know exactly what to do. She produced, from somewhere Edmund did not inquire about, a dressmaker who arrived the following morning with bolts of fabric and the brisk competence of someone accustomed to miracles on short timelines. Cecily submitted to the process with the expression of someone who had learned to be suspicious of things that felt like gifts, but who was finding the suspicion difficult to maintain in the face of a bolt of deep blue silk that was precisely the color of the Adriatic on the mended Atlas page. Edmund did not see the finished result until the evening of the assembly. He was waiting at the bottom of the staircase. He had told himself he was simply ready early. When she appeared at the top, the blue dress, her hair properly arranged for once, dark and neat, her chin lifted with the particular angle of someone who was frightened, but had decided not to show it, something happened to his chest. She came down the stairs and stopped in front of him, and he looked at her with the same attention he gave to the Mercator, to the Ortelius, to things of genuine and irreplaceable value. "Well," she said, with a trace of her usual directness. "You look," he said, "exactly like yourself." She blinked. He thought it was the right thing to have said. The assembly was everything he had remembered. The candlelight, the noise, the careful social choreography of a county that had been watching itself for generations. He felt the familiar constriction the moment they entered, the weight of collective attention shifting toward them, recalibrating. He offered her his arm and she took it, and he felt her fingers tighten slightly against his sleeve, just once, just briefly, and then steady. They were approached within minutes. Lady Pemberton, gracious and curious. Sir Thomas Hale, who had known Edmund since childhood and covered his surprise at Edmund's attendance with practiced ease. Others in succession, all with variations of the same question in their eyes. "Who is she?" And why has the reclusive Duke brought her here? Edmund answered the unasked question by the simple mechanism of not releasing her arm, and by the way, he looked at her when she spoke, with the full, unhurried attention he gave to things he considered worth attending to. Then came the waltz. He asked her. She looked at him with an expression that suggested she was weighing the consequences and finding them acceptable, and she said yes. He had danced before. He had danced at dozens of assemblies and balls in the years before his self-imposed exile, and he had done it with the competent detachment of someone performing a social function. This was not that. This was Cecily's hand in his, her other hand at his shoulder, the blue silk moving as they moved, and the extraordinary fact of her looking up at him with those direct eyes and not performing anything at all. Simply being present, in the way she was always present, fully and without artifice. "You're watching me," she said. "Yes, people will talk. Let them," he said. Something shifted in her expression, something that was not quite the precursor to a smile, but something more than that, something that was beginning to look, he thought, like trust. They were separated briefly during the supper interval, and it was then that a man, Edmund recognized as Mr. Gerald Fitch, charming, well-connected, the kind of man who moved through rooms like he owned them, found Cecily near the refreshment table. Edmund saw it from across the room. He could not hear what was said. He watched Fitch lean in with the practiced ease of someone delivering a confidence, and he watched Cecily's expression shift, not dramatically, but enough. Something that had been open closed slightly. She looked across the room and found Edmund's eyes, and there was a question in hers that had not been there before. He excused himself from the conversation he was not attending to and crossed the room. "Miss Vane," he said. Fitch smiled at him with the smooth cordiality of someone who was not remotely concerned. "Ashford, I was just telling Miss Vane what a surprise it is to see you here. 3 seasons of absence, and suddenly you reappear with..." The pause was precisely calibrated. "A companion." "Yes," Edmund said, and the word was very flat and very cold. "I was simply telling her," Fitch continued pleasantly, "that Ashford is known for his enthusiasms, his atlases, his library, his various projects." Another pause. "I'm sure she'll find the position very comfortable while it lasts." Cecily said nothing. Her chin was up, her expression composed. But Edmund knew her composure now, knew what it was built over. He looked at Fitch with the particular quality of attention he reserved for things he was about to remove from his library. "Mr. Fitch," he said, "I find I am done with this conversation." He offered Cecily his arm. She took it. They found a quiet corner of the room, near a window that looked out onto the dark garden, and she stood for a moment looking out at the darkness. "He said you collect things," she said, "interests, projects, that you are known for it." "He did. Is it true?" Edmund was quiet for a moment. He looked at her reflection in the window glass, the blue dress, the careful composure, the chin that was trying to stay lifted. "I have been known to pursue things with intensity," he said. "Atlases, cartography, the history of exploration." He paused. "But Miss Vane, I want you to hear me clearly." He waited until she turned from the window to look at him directly. "You are not a project. You are not an enthusiasm. You are the person who walked into my library and repaired something I had not realized was broken, and I have been trying since that evening to find the honest words for what that means." She looked at him. The composure was still there, but something behind it was different, less defended, more open. "I don't know how to trust this," she said quietly and honestly. "I know," he said. "I am not asking you to trust it completely. I am asking you to trust it enough to let me try. The garden was very dark beyond the glass. Inside, the assembly continued its warm, indifferent noise. All right, she said finally. It was not a large word. It carried considerable weight. He did not touch her. He simply stood beside her, shoulder to shoulder, looking out at the dark garden. And that was enough. The Dowager Duchess of Ashford arrived at Ashford Park on a Monday. Edmund had not told her to come. She had simply come, as she had always done, on the logic that she was his mother and the house was hers, in the way that all things are ours, that we have loved for long enough. She was a small woman with silver hair and the kind of energy that made rooms feel immediately occupied, and she embraced Mrs. Holt in the entrance hall and demanded tea and asked where Cecily was before she had removed her traveling coat. She found Cecily in the library. Edmund, who had heard the carriage, found them both there 20 minutes later. His mother in the chair he had come to think of as his, Cecily on the footstool. Both of them talking with the ease of two people who have been corresponding for months and are simply now doing it in person. His mother looked up at him with bright, unrepentant eyes. She's wonderful, she said, as if Cecily were not present. I told you she would be wonderful. You told me, Edmund said, that she needed somewhere to be useful. Both things can be true. His mother rose and kissed his cheek. The county is talking, Edmund. I've had 4 letters this week. I'm aware. They're saying you've lost your mind. Also possible. His mother looked at him for a long moment with the particular attention of someone who has watched a person she loves be in pain for 3 years and is now watching something different. Her expression did something complicated. Good, she said. It was past time. The crisis, when it came, arrived in the form of Edmund's cousin, Mr. Reginald Ashford, who appeared at Ashford Park on a Wednesday with the air of someone who had been sent and was not enjoying the errand. He was a thin, precise man with a talent for making reasonable-sounding arguments for unreasonable positions. And he sat in the drawing room and laid out his case with the methodical patience of someone reading from a prepared document. The dukedom required a strategic alliance. Edmund's continued absence from society had created uncertainty. There was a young woman, the daughter of the Earl of Weston, who was eminently suitable and whose family was prepared to be receptive. The county's current interest in Miss Vane was, he paused, choosing his words with care, a distraction. A temporary one, certainly, but a distraction nonetheless. Cecily was not in the room. She was in the library. Edmund sat very still and listened to all of it. No, he said, when Reginald had finished. Reginald blinked. I beg your pardon. No. Edmund set down his tea. The answer is no. It was no before you finish speaking, and it will remain no regardless of what follows. Edmund. Reginald leaned forward with the urgency of a man who has been tasked with a mission he is failing. I understand that Miss Vane is... She seems a pleasant enough young woman, but she has no family, no connections, no... She has, Edmund said, with a quiet that was not calm so much as the absence of anything that was not absolute certainty. More substance than anyone I have encountered in 3 years of being presented with women of excellent family and considerable connections. She walked into my library and repaired a 300-year-old atlas with her bare hands. She told me I had removed my windows to avoid drafts. She held my hand in the dark and did not ask for anything in return. He looked at his cousin. I have spent 3 years building walls that I told myself were reasonable. She has spent her life in rooms where no one saw her. We are, he said, very done with that. Reginald stared at him. I will be calling on Miss Vane this afternoon, Edmund said, to ask her a question. I would appreciate it if you were not in the house when I do. He found her in the library, as he had known he would. She was at the window looking out at the park, where the October light was doing something extraordinary to the trees. She heard him come in and turned, and she saw something in his face that made her own expression go very still. "Your cousin was here," she said. "Yes." "I heard the carriage arrive." She looked at her hands. "Edmund, if there is pressure, if the family requires..." "Cecily." He crossed the room. He stopped in front of her, close enough that she had to look up to meet his eyes. "I need you to listen to me." She looked up. "I spent 3 years in this house," he said, "telling myself that distance was wisdom, that the walls I built were protection, that I had simply chosen a quieter life." He paused. "You walked through my door with paste on your fingers and sat cross-legged on my floor and told me I was taller than you expected, and something happened that I did not know how to name for a very long time." Her breath had changed. "I see you," he said. "Not as a companion, not as a project, not as a solution to a problem. I see you, the way you hold a brush when you are repairing something, and the way you look at a map as if it is telling you a story, and the way you say remarkable when you mean it, and not when you don't." His voice was rough with the effort of saying all of it. "I see you, Cecily, and I choose you, deliberately, and without reservation, and regardless of what my cousin or the county or anyone else requires of me." She was very still. "You are not someone who should have to make herself small," he said. "You never were." For a moment she simply looked at him, and he could see the old wariness working against something newer and stronger. The habit of not trusting warmth, fighting the evidence of 3 months of warmth that had not run out. Then she said, very quietly, "I'm frightened." "So am I," he said. "I have been frightened since the second morning when I came to the library and told myself it was about the Ortelius." Something broke open in her expression. The composure, finally, did not hold. But what was underneath it was not pain. It was something else. Something that looked, he thought, like arriving. She stepped forward and he caught her hands in both of his, and she looked up at him with eyes that were very bright. "Ask me," she said. "Will you marry me?" "Yes," she said. It was not a large word. It was the largest word he had ever heard. He pressed his forehead to hers, and they stood like that in the library where everything had begun, with the October light coming through the windows and the atlases on their shelves, and the fire burning steadily behind them. They were married in the village church on a morning in December, with Mrs. Holt weeping openly in the second pew, and the Dowager Duchess of Ashford occupying the first, with the expression of a woman who has been entirely right about something important and intends to remember it. The vows were the traditional ones, but when Edmund looked at Cecily and said the words, what he meant was, "I see you. I choose you. I am done with walls." She looked back at him, and what she meant was, "I believe you." 2 years later, the East Library was warm at all hours. The Atlas cabinet had been properly sealed, and the Bleu binding had held, and the Mercator had been given a small stand of its own, which was where Edmund found Cecily on a January afternoon, their daughter asleep, against her shoulder with the boneless certainty of a child who has never doubted her welcome. "Tell me again," Cecily said, without looking up from the atlas she was examining one-handed. He came to stand beside her. He knew what she meant. They had made a ritual of it. "You were sitting cross-legged on the floor," he said, "with paste on your fingers, mending the Adriatic. And you stood in the doorway for a very long time." "I did." "Because you were going to tell me to be careful with the atlas. Because, he said, I had not seen anyone look at something the way you were looking at that atlas, and I did not know what to do with that. She looked up at him then, and her expression was the one he had been learning for 2 years, the one that was not quite a smile, but was something more than that, something that had decided. Remarkable, she said. It still meant something when she used it. He kissed her temple, careful of the sleeping child, and looked out the window at the January park, where the light was cold and clear, and the trees stood bare against a pale sky. The house was no longer holding its breath. Thank you for staying with Edmund and Cecily until the very end. Their story began in a library, with a torn atlas and a woman who asked no permission before she began to repair it. And it became, I think, a story about what happens when two people who have spent years making themselves smaller finally decide to take up space. If that moved something in you, I hope you'll subscribe and ring the bell. There are more stories like this one waiting. More impossible loves and hard-won choices, and people who find each other in the quietest, most unexpected rooms. You are the reason these stories exist, and I am grateful you were here.